You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 257.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. For me, we are now fully in the Hanukkah holiday, going to light some menorahs very quickly later today. And so this begins the holiday season. So I hope that Aaron and I can do a series of end-of-year episodes, as we usually do. I think there's quite a bit going on this year. We have to look back. We have to look forward. Do we have to look sideways? I don't know. What would that look like? Maybe Aaron can help me figure that one out. That would be a third episode. But today's episode concerns the debate that I did in episode 251, where I defended democracy, despite all the frustrations with it, from the idea that monarchy is preferable. Very fascinating debate if you're interested. That is episode 251. I also wrote a blog post about the experience, which I think for those of you who are either doing debates or just doing public speaking in general, you might be interested in, called 9 Tips for Participating in a Public Debate. I shouldn't hold up one finger. I should hold up 9 fingers. 9 Tips for Participating in a Public Debate. You can get that on the show notes page at localmaxradio.com/247 or also my personal blog at maxsklar.com. So to discuss these things, today we're talking to the expert, the one who organizes the largest political debating society in New York, I believe, or at least the most fun one, even though he does have some words for me when I talk about entertainment, but we'll get to that in a minute. But that will be Gene Epstein, and he runs and moderates the Soho Forum, which is a monthly debate series by the Reason Foundation. Gene is no stranger to the Local Maximum. He was also on with us in episode 176, if you remember from last year, as an economist to talk about capitalism and innovation. He's going to critique both my debate and my article, and then we're going to talk about some of his recent debates, particularly one that he did with Benjamin Applebaum of the New York Times. I guess, what's the point of running a debate event if you are a debate society if you can't get in the ring yourself every once in a while and do the debate? So that is exciting. Also, if you like listening to these things, these debates, go to thesohoforum.org, and you can get tickets to go live in New York, or you can just listen online. I want to highlight the next debate concerning monetary policy will be on January 26th. So check that out. All right. Without further delay, let's introduce our guest of the week, the founder of the Soho Forum, Gene Epstein. You've reached another Local Maximum. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much, Max. It's a privilege and pleasure to be on the Local Maximum for a second time.
Yeah.
I know you don't invite guests back unless you felt they were interesting the first time. So quite relieved that I made the grade with the great Max Sklar.
Well, you know, people saw the debate, and there were a couple people who were like, oh man, you did a debate. Wouldn't it be cool if you had Gene Epstein on and gave you a little coaching session? So it was backed by popular demand.
Oh, okay. Well, that's nice, Max. It wasn't really your free choice. It was just that your fans wanted me back.
Of course I had to choose to do it too. So,
okay, Max, this is ridiculous. Here I am fishing for a compliment like some jerk. So I'll back off. Yeah, it's a privilege to be back. Pleasure to be back. And but you did, you know, for those of your many fans who don't know, you did a debate at the Shell in New Hampshire. And one of the things that I want to suggest is, first of all, make sure that the audio is good when it comes to the Q&A. I know for some reason the audio really faded when people started to ask questions. I don't know why that's the case.
Well, there was no microphone for the people asking questions. So it was just the microphone on the stage, and it was actually my podcast equipment. It was so they asked me to be like, I didn't realize that I had to be the AV person as well as the debater, and I was kind of like taken aback because I was like, wait a minute, I'm preparing for the debate. I can't set up the microphones. I could bring my microphones, but that was kind of an afterthought because I was more worried about the debate.
All right. Well, all right. Yeah, I know. It's just, yeah, New Hampshire is some, you guys up there, you free state, sometimes you give anarchy a bad name
because anarchy
tends to be identified with disorganization, that there's no manager and all that. But okay. That aside as well, there should be a moderator who runs things, a moderator who just knows a few things to do. Dennis Pratt was sitting in the front row. He should have been the moderator. Dennis Pratt, by the way, to announce, make a special announcement almost for the first time, Dennis Pratt will be a moderator at my forthcoming debate with David Friedman at Porkfest in late June. And David and I are going to debate an issue about which he and I do deeply disagree. As you perhaps know, David makes a big thing about repudiating what I prefer to call the zero aggression principle, or of course more commonly called the non-aggression principle. Thinking of it as relatively useless to make libertarian arguments, and then in fact arguing that it doesn't really hold up as a principle. That David does. I think David is a very valuable thinker in every other way, but I believe that he's a flawed thinker in this regard. And I thought it'd be interesting for us to have a debate on that issue. Now, Dennis is going, and that will be at the Shell, at Porkfest.
Up in, what's the town even called? Lancaster, I think.
Lancaster, New Hampshire. Yeah. And David has agreed to it. To the debate, and he's going to defend a resolution having to do with it. I'm going to take the negative. But in particular, the moderator, as I've told Dennis Pratt, make sure you, as moderator, steer the Q&A such that if a question is addressed to debater A, you turn to debater B for comments on the question. In other words, so that it doesn't really matter who gets the question directly. The other side gets to comment, and of course gets to comment on the nature of the answer given as well as on the question, so that we have a decent debate going during the Q&A. Now, this wasn't even done all the time at your particular debate, as I recall.
Yeah. It was less, you know, it's not that this debate was the minor leagues. You know, you run the major leagues. So, you know, we're just trying to get it together.
Okay. Oh, come on. All right. Yeah. Okay, Max. I gather you're a high paid professional in your field. And okay, it was the minor leagues. The point is that there's no reason why you shouldn't aspire to run the debate.
You're right.
Correctly. I don't know. Look, again, as I come in.
No, it's good. It's good feedback. But
looking for the Shell. And of course, you guys don't mind being insulted. I said, the Shell looks like some garbage dump from the outside. So I wasn't sure I was in the right place.
a little bit.
But then you enter it and it kind of, you know, has a nice funky feel about it. And Dennis likes to show movies. And I gather that that technology is pretty good. When I was at the Shell, if you may recall, I sat in the hot seat about my debate with Ben Burgess about socialism, and Dennis showed the debate, and then I answered questions about it and comments from the audience. So anyway, have decent audio. Try to respect the listeners, and I don't know. Tell now, Dennis. Dennis, of course, is a great man and a great philosopher, but of course he often eschews being an administrator. Anyway, I'm belaboring the point. Make sure you have microphone for everybody so that it can be heard. If you expect people to listen to it, look, we're going to segue into your 9 points for debaters.
Yes, I also have notes on your debate too because I listened to it.
In the audience, recognize the first point is your primary mission is to entertain the audience. That's your that's your mission, and yet recognize that if the audience is going to be maximally entertained, they'd like to hear what goes on, and that includes, of course, if you're releasing it on podcast and on video, then make sure that it can be heard. We've recently screwed up in a couple of ways that bother me at the Soul Forum. We've screwed up, and of course we have a responsibility to our audience not to screw up. So okay, with that little lecture, I'm just wondering.
Point well taken.
I want to segue into your list of 9 points, which interested me.
Okay. Cool.
I have it in front of me. But then also, I guess, let me comment on your debate. I basically enjoyed it. It could, as a matter of fact, it would have, if I'd scheduled it as a sole form debate. I probably would have had it at Porkfest because it's a kind of a fun debate. It's ultimately not quite as clear an issue as for me as a libertarian as
well. Let's review what it is because they're not familiar. It was the democracy. Okay,
that.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I didn't have enough faith in you. I'll let you go.
Too much of a prelude. Yeah. It was about monarchy versus democracy, right. And my first criticism, Max, of you was that had you asked me in advance how to prepare, I would say to you, do a deep dive into the book by Hans Hermann Hoppe.
Yes.
Oddly enough, in other words, here Hans Hermann Hoppe is a brilliant mind, even though he seems to have a thing about homosexuals. Yeah, a brilliant mind, even though he's been.
Yeah, he's not. Fun. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, is he not a fan? All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
What's your point, Ryan?
No. I was just echoing what you said. So,
I wanted to, before as being a rationally garrulous person, I wanted to say recently that the recent attacks on Hans Hermann Hoppe, launched by Phil Magnus, were partly valid. You know, he's scoring a few points against Hans. And I had a conversation with Stefan Kinsella, who's a friend of Hans's. And I said to Stefan, just read the stuff that Hans writes about gay people. He seems to think that if you advocate for homosexuality, you can persuade people to be gay. I said, well, maybe a few, but the vast majority of us really have no choice. There's an absence of free will when it comes to our sexual proclivities. You know, 99% of us, at least, we pretty much choose being gay or straight inadvertently, unintentionally. We really just fall into for Hans to really think that he wrote at one point that in our community we're gonna kick people out who advocate for homosexuality. He's clearly a homophobe. He's got something wrong.
What? Yeah. That's a little weird. Not just weird, but it's like disturbing. Like, you know, I wouldn't want to have, you know, there'd be friends of mine, people in my family.
Of course.
Obviously.
Of course.
Well, you're a New Yorker.
But then he actually had in the context of saying about advocating for socialism, homosexuality, as though advocating for socialism is the same thing as advocating for homosexuality. Even if you had a friend who frequently tried to advocate for homosexuality, you wouldn't necessarily terminate the friendship. You would say, look, I'm stuck with being a goddamn heterosexual. I can't choose homosexuality. You can't persuade me to do it because it's just not my thing. It was just ingrained in me. So my point there is that I wanted to, I told Stefan was uncomfortable about that, and I said, Stefan, you should acknowledge in defending Hans a few of his problems, and Stefan can't do that because he's a friend of Hans's. And I said, and Stefan said, well, I'm going to quit defending him altogether. I said, well, yeah, you probably should. The point is that I wanted to write a tweet and say anybody who was going to deny himself the work of Hans Hermann Hoppe, because he's got a few rather crazy quirks, is doing himself a disservice. Hans Hermann Hoppe is a very stimulating thinker. Even when you disagree with him or don't quite agree with him, he's really worth reading for any libertarian. And of course, getting back to you and his book about monarchy versus democracy, I'm a little surprised that you didn't simply get up and say, even though he's not here to refute
by the way. I did get the book. I didn't have time to read it all, but I did get the book and I did look through it.
You didn't have time to read it all.
No.
All right. I guess
this is not the solo forum. I'm not getting paid for this.
Once again, in the minor leagues, I guess. Well, as a matter of fact, the book is a little bit repetitive. I know it's got the essays that sort of repeat with each other, and I re-listened to it on Audible again last week, and I found that once I was about an hour and a half in, he began to repeat his points, and so I don't think it would have been a huge chore to be able to do that. I think you should have quoted Hans. You should have said that here is a deep thinker, very thoughtful guy. His I don't know if you know Hans's book, A Short History of Man, is quite stimulating. You know that book?
No, I don't.
Well, it's quite good. I mean, all of his essays are stimulating and often persuasive. Okay, so again, I've been lingering too much on Hans, but I would have said that you should have targeted Hans Hermann Hoppe, and you would have said, even though he's not here to respond, I'm going to quote him copiously and respond. I guess I have to think about what did you miss? He went into a lot of different history. What did you miss in Hans Hermann Hoppe? Well, actually, let me give it to you. It's almost like I'm conducting the interview. What do you think missed? What do you think you missed? And maybe review the argument. You were, for the listeners, I guess I should have said, although you picked up on it, I guess, that Max was defending democracy against an opponent who was defending monarchy.
Yeah, so first of all, let me like start how this happened. This was actually, the debate. I'm kind of, somehow I got invited to that to the debate Signal channel because maybe I had been to a couple of those because I was a fan of the Soho Forum. So I said, why not go to a few here? Yeah. And so I got on the channel, and then it was Alu himself who wanted to debate this topic, and so he kind of wrote the resolution.
I forget. Yeah. Your opponent. What's his name?
His name is, people call him Alu. I think his name is Elliot, but
he's called Alu. So,
Alu.
Crazy New Hampshire.
I don't know. So he was the one who wanted to debate it, and he put it out, and I was like, I always wanted to do a debate. I spoke to Gene. Gene's recommended I try a debate one day, and I was like, let me say, sure, I'll do it. And because it's a topic that, that interests me. I thought it would be a little bit of a challenge. So I did it, but it wasn't like, I wasn't the one pushing the issue. Like I wasn't the one gunning to debate this particular issue. It was him. And I think he kind of likes to debate things that are more socially dangerous. So I was kind of cognizant of the fact that no one's going to come to me and be like, I'm not going to be on job interview. They're like, what? You once defended democracy? Get out of here. So he was taking the much more, socially risky position. So I do give him like a lot of credit for that. Honestly, that was such a, like, when I was done, I'm going to have to rewatch it at some point, but I was done, it was like so nerve-wracking that I put it aside. And I was I don't want to rewatch it for a while. Thought that I had trouble. I had trouble juggling coming up with my own statements and figuring out which one of his to respond to. Like, I really didn't have a good intuition of like, what is he saying that the audience is connecting with that I should respond to?
Yeah.
And what is he saying that I should just let go? And I don't know, maybe I did okay on that, but I was just I found that I was flustered. I didn't know exactly what to do.
Also, Max, by the way, I mean, once again, I guess you were in the monolith. Bear in mind that I listened to it when I did an interview, for example, on my recent debate with a New York Times editorial writer, and Tom Woods asked me to discuss it on his show, and of course, I felt I got to do my homework and watch my debate so that I don't miss it. Because oddly enough, this is the odd experience. And of course, when I appeared at the Shell to discuss my debate with Ben Burgess, I subjected myself to listening to it once again in preparation. And of course, it's a little bit painful to see yourself up there. But I guess you avoided that ordeal. You didn't prepare for this discussion.
I will get back to it. But I did prepare for this discussion by listening to your debate and to the Tom Woods discussion.
That's a little less painful.
It was wonderful. It wasn't less painful. It wasn't painful at all.
Painful because you're not up there. That's the point. You have to watch yourself up there.
Okay. Okay.
It's a little bit more painful.
I will pledge to subject myself to that at some point in the near future. In the next month.
Should have done it in preparation for this interview.
Okay.
I'm marking you down. Okay.
It's all right.
But anyway, that aside,
that's two markdowns.
The only thing I can say about the monarchy, I found it stimulating. It's obviously a little academic for sure, because we don't think monarchy is coming back. A little academic for sure, because no libertarian favors monarchy. It's just comparing one thing with the other. But it is stimulating. And I guess since I've been basically sort of a little bit harsh on you, Max, because I deeply respect you. That's why I give you a hard time. Only because
I appreciate it.
But I have to praise the point, a couple of points you made one of them having to do with the problems of succession, and that maybe you didn't put a fine enough point on it, you know, the wars of succession, that Hans, Hermann Hoppe, and of course, Alu, your opponent, they talk about so this sort of like the long-term investment that you're looking for something, Max.
But, yeah. Oh, no, no, no. I'm just taking notes, checking the time, making sure we're all good.
Sure. You might have, you set me to thinking that really the only key point that has to be made by the pro-monarchist wing and by Hans Hermann Hoppe is that the king has a long-term investment in this property, and what's the term that Hans uses, which of course your guy should have quoted Hans a little bit because there's some good,
right? Yeah,
that the
I expected him to a little bit more, and so yeah, when
the politician is just a temporary caretaker, I forget
right
what diminishing terminology is used, but you might have put a finer, you know, when you talked about wars of succession, you might have pointed out that, well, that assumes that you might have even cited the show Succession. Have you seen it?
I've seen parts of Succession, but I was thinking more of House of Dragon at the time.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. The point is that, but not infrequently, because of regression toward the mean, because of a king who's got a lot of, you know, or a queen who's got a lot of foresight and a lot of wisdom, you're very disappointed in your children, and they're rather ditzy. They're not really that capable, and you know, as similar to the Godfather, you know, Fredo the oldest doesn't get chosen. Once Sonny is killed, Michael gets chosen. You know, and the point is that you then, you know, in the case of the Godfather, because then you have Fredo plotting against Michael. So the point is, you know, this idea that there's going to be this orderly succession when it comes to heredity is a little bit up in the air, you know, as to whether it can really happen. And as you said, you could have really bad times when that kind of division happens. When, let's say, the younger sibling is given the job and the older sibling decides to lead a revolt among his loyalists, you know.
Yeah. That was actually one of the arguments where I wasn't sure how strong it was until I did a little bit of research.
Yeah.
And then I found out just how common it was. And also, like, and then I found out, like, Mises had commented on it as one of the big problems. And some friends of mine who are not in these circles were like, well, who's that? And I'm like, no, this group is going to love that.
Where did Mises comment on it? Do you know?
So I had a quote from him, and I can't bring it up in front of me right now, but where his argument for one of his main arguments for democracy was preventing these kinds of wars. And so once I saw him making that argument, I'm like, okay, it's good that he's making that argument, because that really helps my argument for this audience.
Oh, preventing the wars of succession. Yeah, right. I mean, I gather. Actually, you inspired me to think of my Bible, my Old Testament. You know, I guess you're not Jewish, are you, Max?
I am.
So if you're Jewish, and you probably know your Bible was after King, what was it? After Solomon, I guess. Well, there was a really, you know, the Absalom, the Solomon's kids, the kingdom divided.
The split between Israel and Judah, the north and the south.
Because of a succession problem, I believe. Yeah. And because again, you don't. And in the case of the serious succession, which is of course about business, he doesn't think any of his kids can really take over. Mm. And so there's an incredible amount of fight between them. And so indeed, I guess that's a kind of a key point. So you don't get this great foresight on the part of the king necessarily. And then indeed, I know, just because it's your children, do you really have a long-term investment? You know, and then, of course, obviously, you still have a kind of a dynastic attitude on the part of some politicians as well, by the way.
Right.
You know, and so, and there are, I mean, you and I obviously are libertarians, and we don't have much of a high regard for politicians. And we do see, of course, some force to the argument that they're temporary and that they'll loot the treasury and all that, the rest. But every once in a while, they care about how they're depicted in the history books, you know.
Sure.
And so the differences are not as stark as Hans tried to emphasize.
I also tried to make the argument, and people, I got some feedback that it wasn't, they were kind of confused about where I was going with it, like with the argument about the test that you're going to take, where I was trying to make the argument that at some point you're, you know, I'm a huge believer in economics. I'm a huge believer that incentives work, but on the individual level, at some point your incentives are maxed out. At some point, you know, either a person doesn't want to do something and there's nothing you could pay them to get them, could get them to do it, or they're incapable of doing something. So no matter how much incentive you give them, they're not going to do it. And I think that applies to a monarch too. Like if you're like, well, just think about 50 years from now, make the best decisions. How do they know?
Oh, they have no idea
what they're going to do. Yeah. And so I was trying to make that argument. I felt like it didn't get through as strongly as I could have made it.
Yeah, no. That was a good point, I guess. And then actually, when you played the Bismarck card, you said, you know, here the welfare state, the model for the welfare state originated basically under a king. So the idea that the other part of Hans's argument, I guess the key argument that under democracy people vote. People vote for the politician who keeps giving them transfer payments, and there's some validity to that. But then, of course, the motivation for the king to provide bread and circuses, you know, the emperors in Roman times to provide transfer payments to the populace in order to win popular support, there's a powerful incentive to do that as well. And of course, when King Henry, come to think of it, another inspiration, King Henry Louis XIV, you know, the famous French line, après-moi le déluge. You know what that means?
Yes. After me, the flood.
After me, you know, the deluge meaning the mess. And I don't even, you know, he had kids, so he didn't even give a damn, you know. So,
yeah.
So it's all a bit exaggerated. And of course, then the strengths of the democracy are, I mean, every once in a while, you do have, you know, maybe the most heartening thing to my mind about the recent exercise of voting is that, you know, the politicians who were on the side of the teachers unions, who were basically against school choice, was it in Pennsylvania, the guy who said parents are not the ones to decide about schooling, he got trounced.
Virginia, I think. I could be wrong. Was that the one with like Glenn Youngkin last year and Terry McAuliffe?
It slips by me so much. I probably have the wrong state, so I'm just showing how poorly I follow all this electoral politics. But certainly
it's probably better off.
Certainly it was heartening to see the voter. As a matter of fact, it was Richard Epstein, who was no relation of mine. But when I was asking why some of these upset voting, he said, "Well, the one thing you can't you start telling parents they have no say in their kids' education, then that's death at the ballot box, you know," and so on. And so every once in a while, you find heartening intelligence on the part of the people and rebellion against war. You know, if a war goes on too long, they start getting weary and you suffer at the ballot box, you know, for that reason as well. So there's some virtues in the ballot box. Yeah.
Yeah. It would be interesting to go, because I was playing defense on this, where he wanted to argue that monarchy was better. And I felt like that gave me sort of an advantage because I didn't have to necessarily prove democracy was better. I feel like it would be an interesting task to kind of flip it around and try to go on offense. It would be a harder case just because it's a much stronger statement to say democracy is better. But like, it would be interesting to try to do that. I don't know what the results
would be. Well, just a moment, Max. Actually, I'm not sure. Now, oddly, forgive me, but I'm forgetting. You were the affirmative?
No, I was the negative. He was saying,
"Oh, he was
like,
the affirmative."
Yeah,
the wording of the resolution was strictly what again?
It was monarchy is better than representative democracy. So it was a greater than sign. It was, you know.
Well, okay, Max. I guess all that really amounts to is that. To say the burden of proof, really, for you
he
to
put the burden of proof on himself with the resolution.
Well, I think you're exaggerating a little bit. Okay. No, oddly. Strictly speaking, if that's the wording, let me explain something to you, which is a strong issue for me. The if you take the negative, then indeed you could be defending the resolution, which would be to say that democracy, that monarchy is no better than democracy. In other words, you're correct to say that. You're not necessarily flipping it and saying democracy is better than monarchy. You're simply saying that they're both, you know, maybe two lumps of shit, and you really can't choose. One has virtues, the other has vices, you know, and so on. So that's the only burden on him. But I guess you could say that's a burden. But my point is that what I like to do when I take the negative on certain, as I did with Benjamin Applebaum, the New York Times guy, he said that that it's largely responsible, that the free market is largely responsible for the disappointing performance of the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
And I began by saying that there is a burden on him in the sense that even if it's partly responsible, then he can't sustain his case. That I don't even think it's partly responsible, but even if he would approve that, he won't have made his case because he's saying it's largely responsible. So, yeah, all right. So I guess we're basically in the same ballpark about burdens of proof with respect to debates, although every once in a while, because when you think about how the audience voted and what they're really processing, you wonder whether these fine points really register with them unless you keep emphasizing them over and over again. I wanted to go to your first point about your primary mission is to entertain the audience.
I feel like that might be, how do you feel about that? That might
now
be
Max
a little...
and I are going to have a debate. Max is going to defend the resolution that the primary mission of a debater, he's taking the affirmative, I'm taking the negative. So go ahead, Max. You've got 5 minutes to defend the resolution. Take it away.
Well, if you're not going to entertain them, why are they going to show up? I'm done. I yield the rest of my time.
Well, okay, there's no
I mean, way. Look, I obviously you can't just like go up there and put on a show that has nothing to do with the debate or the resolution, but you do have to put the work in to like to grab people in and make your argument compelling and make your argument interesting. And I think you do a good job of that. And I think most of the debaters in the SOHO forum do a good job of that. If somebody doesn't do a good job of that, then it definitely hurts them in the voting. I've noticed. So, yeah.
I guess it's a matter of emphasis. I would say that the entertainment, in terms of what the word usually denotes, has to be secondary. But really, I guess maybe you and I are simply using different words for the same point. The thing that I believe makes the people buy tickets to the SOHO Forum events, at least in part, is that it's a piece of theater, and that it could be, you know, when you speak about entertainment, think of some of the worst. Think of great tragic dramas that you might like, or tragic films.
Yeah.
They are, so to speak, entertaining, but they're not necessarily funny. They're simply dramatic. And simply as well, then the clash of ideas and clash of personalities as well that naturally results from a SOHO Forum debate, which I, by the way, I like to maintain as one-on-one debates because for lots of reasons, but partly because I think that increases the drama. I think that people, I used to have a weakness for heavyweight boxing, like so many, you know, hundreds of millions of others in the world, when it was a big deal. Because again, it's the few things more dramatic than the clash between one person and another person. One versus one clashes are perhaps the most dramatic, of course, and obviously the dramatic clash between teams in soccer, baseball, basketball, all of course pieces of theater as well as athletic events. And this, so my SOHO Forum then is a piece of theater, just like yours was, where you debated, and so the theatricality of it comes naturally, and so therefore I don't think that you should try hard to entertain, if you convince the audience then that's enough of a struggle that if you that's your primary aim is to convince the audience of your position. That's why I wouldn't put entertain up. You're sort of nodding. I wouldn't put entertaining up on the marquee. And to the extent, although I would agree that to the extent that you can use humor, that you can make it. Yeah, then
and by the way, and like you said, entertainment is much broader than that. It doesn't have to be humor, you know. Although there are a lot of things that come up in debates like this that are inherently humorous. You know,
humorous. Well, yeah, okay.
Because it's kind of funny when you have people. When it's almost like a little bit funny when you have someone contradicting someone else. You know, it's
yes, indeed. Just, no, of course,
and uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, my happy horse line, I guess, actually, I think I probably said this when I first interviewed with you, and I repeated it ad nauseum, perhaps, is that when my friend Tom Woods tries to reassure people who have stage fright when they lecture before an audience that everybody in the audience is pulling for you, my point with Tom is that yes, there's a fat footnote there, except when you're in a solo form in debate or in a debate, because maybe a lot of the audience has their knives out for you, and then more to the point, there's somebody on stage who's contradicting you, so he's not pulling for you at all, and so it's a rather stressful a situation to be in, but inherently dramatic, and that's why I would say the primary mission is still to convince the audience and not to entertain the audience. I would say that if they want to just see a song and dance musical that is or a comedy that we more strictly associate with entertainment, then that's their privilege. But of course, a lot of people do want to see heavyweight dramas like Hamlet or A Long Day's Journey Into Night or Death of a Salesman, or heavyweight movie dramas that end tragically. And so that's the point about the broad concept of entertainment, which I guess you agree with. But when Aristotle said, Aristotle, who wrote about the great Greek philosopher Aristotle, who wrote his Poetica, wrote about what theater is supposed to be, what plays are all about, is that you evoke in the audience pity and terror. Pity and terror is what he called it, you know, that you electrify them emotionally. I myself, by the way, I tend to avoid horror films. I find they're sort of like scary, and I don't want the experience, but horror films are very popular, as you know. People, and often there's not even any laughs in some of the great horror films, right? So
some of them do have some, right? The only, I'm thinking of like The Scary Movie, which is just like the parodies of them from like 20 years ago. But
parodies that make fun and make them into jokes.
People like that. Same reason people like Roller Coaster. I don't particularly like horror films, but I like roller coasters. So maybe it's the same sort of a situation.
Well, yeah, thrill, a scary experience. So therefore, I would say that the entertainment will naturally, I would modify, my primary mission is to convince the audience, because the setup, the director and the production is already giving them the entertainment that they might seek in seeing an interesting clash of wills, a clash of ideas, the possibility of an outcome, which of course is like, you know, quote unquote outcome. It's just a sampling of the audience, sometimes indecisive sampling, because in my case, only about half the audience actually votes. And so I would say that a margin of victory of at least 5% would imply some kind of victory. And then even then, ultimately, those people are going to watch it on video and listen to it on audio are going to judge who they think won. So it's a kind of an attempt to give a little bit of a theatrical climax to the evening. And that's why I say it's the soul form Tootsie Roll. And I toss the Tootsie Roll at the winner. The moderator does. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. I mean, and that's that's interesting in and of itself, that it's just a little piece of candy. It's the whole thing is about. I think with that first point, I'm just I'm also like convincing myself. It's kind of like a pep talk to tell people, like, you know, don't be so robotic. Don't be. It's not like for me where I'm programming computers all day. This is not writing this is not writing software. You got to get up there. Loosen up. Don't be be human. Is I guess
your inarticulate and inept attempt to just make those points when you say entertain. but no, indeed, you're absolutely right that since it is a theatrical performance, It's certainly, of course, in print, you want to charm and entertain and make it readable. But of course, when you're up there, you're actually talking to the audience. Then I want to recognize that your personality has got to come through. Although it's, maybe you could be directed by others. I accept suggestions from others. As you know, my big taint, which my assistants have now haunted me with, since they're now selling swag with that picture of me on, and they're running on Instagram that moment when I yelled at Bhaskar Sankara, learn some economics.
Oh, and yeah, I was there for that.
It's apparently had hundreds of thousands of views. And my assistant Jane assures me that while that was dumb to do during a debate, he said, every once in a while, some of us do think about some of these progressives, please learn some economics. The yelling at them would be a good idea. But the point is, I made the mistake of losing my temper with Bhaskar Sankara in that particular debate. Actually, some of the audience liked it anyway, but certainly it was unwise of me to do. And so your point is really that while your aim is to convince the audience, what do you want to do? You want to convince the audience, possibly, if possible, with humor. Now, I knew I had a couple of, for example, getting back to my debate, Benjamin Applebaum, again, of the New York Times, he defended the resolution that the free market is largely responsible for the dismal performance of the U.S. economy. And so I knew that I probably had a couple of jokes at his expense when I quoted him on having taken a number to the third decimal point in order to prove his point. He had it, and I used that line, if you torture numbers long enough, they'll confess to anything. And I said, and Benjamin clearly felt it necessary to torture them to the third decimal point in order to get them to confess.
You also had another good line in there, which got a laugh, which was taking his writing on housing and then, I mean, it's kind of an old trick, but then announcing who it was after the, saying, oh, this was written by my opponent here. And then it was, it was pretty funny.
Right.
Because you're thinking like, what is he talking about housing? It's like, oh, that's the other guy's article.
Yeah. I saw Benjamin actually flinch. When I watched the video, I saw Benjamin actually flinch when I mentioned that. So if you possibly can, but oddly, you can't always make jokes. You want the jokes to, you're not up there to make people laugh. You're up there to convince them. And the only thing, of course, obviously, is that you want to the extent that you can, you want your personality involved, but you want the force of your sincerity and your argument to come through. And you don't want to get angry, even though your opponent is sometimes saying outrageously stupid things. And so I always have to control my anger. Because that's a part of me. And that's always good advice. Well, we should go to your other points.
This is, we can have a audience, we could talk a lot about this on point.
Your audience is good. And I guess we agree with that. Although, of course, what I would put up front, of course, obviously, your primary purpose is to convince, the audience of your position, and that in so doing, that I would write in so doing, use humor if you can, but only if it flows naturally from your argument.
You don't want to fit something in that doesn't fit with your particular argument or your personality.
Yeah, no, there are speakers. It's the old convention. A speaker starts with a joke. When I delivered economics talks, I would often use a joke and so on, but which only loosely related to what I was about to say. So that corny stuff, sometimes you still might do it if you deliver a lecture, but not when you're doing a debate. I also think you shouldn't be overly sincere in being nice to your opponent and saying, oh, I'm really grateful, what a worthy, great person. I know, whatever. Sometimes people get a little bit excessive in that way. But also, most importantly, the delicate balance between speaking with great sincerity and even passion, but somehow or other avoiding character assassination against your opponent, and hopefully exposing the your opponent's stupidity without calling him stupid, which of course is difficult for me. But then
your opponents haven't been stupid though. Like, you know, the last guy was clearly very clever.
I guess I put a high bar for stupid. I mean, he's got mighty. Benjamin. What are some of the things he said? Yeah, let me think of some of the things that Benjamin said that were slightly crazy. I mean, when I said to Benjamin,
oh sure, you could get smart people to say things that are slightly crazy or even very crazy.
Okay, well, crazy. Look, pretty ignorant for somebody. You know, when he put in a measure of compensation as a share of gross domestic product, he made two mistakes. But I said he didn't include benefits, I was frustrated that I didn't respond. I said Benjamin obviously values his health benefits and the contributions to a 401k at the New York Times, but he doesn't include that in his measure of compensation. He excludes it. And then he got up and said, well, if you think that medical benefits are worth any more than worth so much today, then you probably don't remember when he said that.
I don't remember that exactly, but if he said that, that's a little, because everybody knows that like health insurance is a big part. It's a big draw for many people for their
job. It's a big draw, and a lot of things. Yes, indeed, and a lot of things that were. And actually, oddly, I tell you this. Maybe you don't know this point that in my day, and when I was in my 20s, I'm now 78. None of us really thought about getting health insurance when we had a job because the cost of seeing a doctor every once in a while was not really that big a deal in your budget. And then secondly, or a dentist. And secondly, if you came down with leukemia, you'd be dead anyway. You know, but that's the key point, so, which is that, or if you needed a bone marrow transplant, the odd possibility that in your 20s, you would catch a really life-threatening disease, you'd be dead anyway. So what's the point? But now, leukemia is no longer a death sentence. You can get bone marrow transplant. If you come down with something serious in your 20s, it could cost a lot of money, but you want the health insurance on the off chance that you get it, because they can save your life. All I'm saying is getting to Benjamin. As you said, health insurance is important. He said that. Okay, he said a lot of dumb things. I don't know if I should dwell on what Benjamin said.
I had a list of things that he said that I was kind of confused by, and we can go into them if you want. But
Go ahead. That he said or that I said.
Yeah, well, right. So I don't know if you respond to this directly, but he said that it's good that we have a welfare state, a safety net, because if we have that safety net, then people are more willing to accept free trade internationally. Oh, yeah. And I'm sort of thinking like, well, okay, but he's saying if we kind of violate free market principles a little bit over here, then that gives us the political leeway to expand free market principles over here. So that's not necessarily attacking free market ideology. That's more of like a political sort of like a statement of political realities, which he could have argued in favor of the social safety net and said, well, this allows us to have better policy over here. I mean, okay, that would be one argument, but like, I just found it a very strange, I almost found that he was trying to make, he was arguing that, restrict free market ideology over here to have it more over here is not a very strong argument, because he's kind of saying, that's how I took it.
He did make that point. I as you know, I preferred to try to point out that he had put a toe in, and that's when I quoted his article, in trying to understand that 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 government policies are making it difficult for people to get other jobs, to have remobility, and that if we made opened up these opportunities for people and didn't constrain them with housing policy as well as with restrictive licensure, then we could cure a lot of the problems that concern him, that we could make it enhance the mobility of labor. So I wanted to harp on that particular point rather than I address the point that you made, which is that indeed I didn't specifically address that point. Although I guess you're making an interesting principled argument that I might make in front of libertarians. Although when you talk about know your audience, number two, in a way, it has to be footnoted to say, know the audience of people. The most subtle thing, know the audience of people who are on the fence. Know the audience of people who might be
persuadable.
Open to because they're going to be there's going to be the two extremes. The people who are going to love you no matter what you do, because I of course all have these fans and you do too, Max. And then the people are going to hate you no matter what you say. And then maybe hopefully the people in the middle. And that's of course a real art and real guesswork as to what will work with people in the middle. But of course, when I made the point that look, I'm to the extent that we have inequality and we're impeding the mobility of labor, then isn't that a concern that Benjamin also shares? And then I quoted from his article about it. So I made that point. But picking up on your point, you said, well, you're sacrificing one principle for another. That would be more of an argument you might make to libertarians. The only other thing I might have said, and I had more time, is that maybe he could cite some empirical data showing this to be the case. That we have more of it. I actually question that because I think you'd have to choose smaller countries like Sweden and other countries. The small country is so dependent on imports that the populace are a little bit better trained to appreciate the point that we really have to have free trade if we're going to survive. The U.S. is a much bigger and more self-contained economy, so there's more of an indifference to the idea. So I'm wondering if even its empirical data are valid. And then just because you give people social safety, if they still feel their jobs are threatened, if there's a powerful steel union feels their jobs are threatened, they'll keep steel out anyway. It's not really going to help. So. But that's a good point. You got anything else,
and this, similarly, I mean, I'm not going to cover the stuff that was already covered, like on Tom Woods, like the growth data, which we've already covered that, the three decimal points. But I didn't quite understand his argument about the cartels. I think he was trying to say, okay, well, a free market economist is going to say you can't have cartels, which is, not quite true. And then it turned out there were a lot more cartels than we thought. But how does that... I don't see how that makes the case for the resolution exactly, because it's like, well, how is, were there people saying, no, keep the cartels? I didn't see that. Like, where's the example? Where's the example of like our government acting on behalf of free market ideologues to keep these cartels?
He didn't say.
Maybe I misunderstood.
He was saying that the government isn't doing enough via antitrust to curb the cartels, and this was all the influence of George Stigler, who was a colleague of Milton Friedman.
That's a little bit closer to what I would have expected.
But again, see, this is another, now when you were asking me the question, where was he dumb? Of course, this is ubiquitous. I find a lot of them are dumb. All I said was that if we're associating cartels in the classic fashion with gouging, with pricing that benefits you, that's why we don't want cartels, because of their abusive pricing policies, which of course is the classic objection. Sometimes you get crazy arguments. Benjamin, by the way, has been all over the map with his argument. But on that evening, he was making the point about pricing. There's collusion and they misbehave with respect to gouging the consumer. So all I said was, let's take the airlines. the inflation rate in with airlines diminished over the last 10 years. There's less pricing power, but as far as we can see. And then all broadly, if you look at the inflation numbers, the fact is that the slowest rate of price inflation across the board was from 2010 to 2020. Until, of course, something else happened, which is easily explained by the explosion of debt and the explosion of money supply. So we had every evidence that the pricing power was weakening. You have a Federal Reserve that constantly wants to goose up price inflation. And we have crazy Binyamin and some of those other lunatics say, oh, the cartels are exercising the pricing power. And so that's, and then if you recall, Binyamin started to cite France. He said, well, France's prices are better, and therefore, with respect to airlines, and that's the reason why we are a cartel. So I said, but Binyamin, don't you also want to look internally at the pricing patterns in the U.S.? So anyway, that's what the argument was there, and that's why, again, the cartel argument is so crazy.
Yeah, I also feel like, as someone who's worked on causality statistical models for profit, I feel like the causal, I have a high bar for causal arguments. You can't just say, this causal happened arguments, and this happened, you know? And so I would have, if you were here, I would have liked to have seen a more comprehensive causal argument for that.
Well, the causal argument, well,
but there, you can't make it.
Well, again, yeah. Max, look, the first place, again, if you see on its face, the airlines measured by the bureaus, the airline fares were mostly down from 2010 to 20, that the pricing power of airlines was weakening. Clear evidence of if you just look at the price patterns as tracked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, does he want to question the numbers? So therefore, on its face, what the evidence you have is that the market was getting more price competitive rather than less. So the manifestation of a cartel, which would be pricing power, is completely the opposite. So in yours, you're almost speaking abstractly, like you'd have an intelligent case. But then he wants to compare it with France. He doesn't, where you obviously run into problems when you start.
There are way too many confounding variables there. Like you can't
compare it with. The point is, on its face, it's a joke. And then, of course, I mean, there are other crazy people like Robert Reich who start saying, well, the cartels now are in charge, when clearly they suddenly got in charge once the monetary explosion happened. The cartels had no power at all, and yet they suddenly got powerful in 2021. So that's the reason why I lose my cool sometimes in thinking about the stupidity of these people and the kind of cockamamie things that they can invent without any evidence at all.
Yeah. So I'll tell you where I think he was. He had some good positioning at one point.
Are you going to get me angry, Max? But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm trying to see it from different points of view. So you brought up his work on housing, and he was very smart to own that and basically say, look, I am not an ideologue. I believe sometimes the free market is good. Sometimes government intervention is good. And if he had organized his thoughts a little better for the audience and just said, hey, look, here are some examples of free market ideologues said X, government did Y, outcome Z, and made it much more compelling. And if he had a few of those, even if we disagreed with the chain of reasoning, but if he kind of hammered home his examples and said, look, I just believe in evidence, then I think it would have been a much stronger argument, much more difficult to, take head on.
Well, broadly speaking, what really happened, Max, was that I felt it was getting, the argument was getting, his debate was falling, to his position in the debate was falling apart so quickly. Basically, he retreated from the resolution, which is to say free market ideology is largely responsible for what's gone wrong with the economy, and I said, really, it's progressive ideology, but I can't prove all that in the limited time allotted. I can only say that Binyamin hasn't made his case. But then, in his own summary, all he's really saying is that we need a balance. He's then taking the high road, and he's saying we need a balance between government and the free market and capitalism. We definitely need capitalism. We definitely need government. He's just making a sort of abstract case for the role of government in the free market. But that has nothing specifically to do with the specific case he's supposed to make, that free market ideology is largely responsible for what went on. He basically retreated from his own argument. And all you're really saying is that he could have...
If he didn't do that, it would have been better.
Yeah, but of course, I was amazed. I picked up 6 points and he picked up 9 points. But of course, it was a small margin, too small to count. But I'm amazed that he even picked up 9 points.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's tough, you know, when you're that... when you start off with such a low number, an audience against you, it's easier to pick up some of the marginal people.
Max, once again, you're the thousandth person I have to correct on that. Yeah. I can only tell you that if you look at the Seoul Forum numbers, you obviously can say,
by the way, that would be an interesting data set. I'd love to, I should write that down and start analyzing.
Max, if you go on our website, past events, you'll find that all of the numbers are provided for like our 72 debates. There was one debate where we couldn't do an Oxford style vote because that was with Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner. His wife demanded that it not be a debate, so we couldn't do an Oxford style vote. But on more than 70 of the debates, we've done an Oxford style vote, and it's easy enough to simply eyeball the numbers and group them. And you'll see that it's pretty much of a wash. The side that starts with 50% or more has as much chance of winning as the side that starts with 10% or more. So use any threshold that you want, and you'll see that it's random. There's no pattern. There's no evidence from our 72 debates with records that the side that starts with a lower percentage.
I'd love to crunch the numbers on that. So maybe I'll try to do that and get back to you.
Well, you're a scientist. I did a simple back of the envelope look, and you're a scientist, so you should take a look. I think you'll find it's just too random. There might be a little bit of an edge, but really not enough. Not enough to write home about that.
Yeah, yeah. The one that I did, I was surprised that it was so even. Well, it was a very small audience, so that's part of it. But I was surprised it was so evenly split to begin with. I had no idea walking in what it was going to look like.
Surprised. Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, on that particular debate, I could imagine that libertarians would sort of be open. Although, by the way, I mean, you're now reminding me of what else I was going to comment on. As you perhaps know, do not announce the initial vote. I could announce the initial vote once it's taken, but I only announce the initial vote and the final vote when the final vote comes in. And I do that partly because I don't want to make too much of a big thing out of the Oxford style voting.
It would also be interesting, like, not to know, because going in, like, I sort of knew, okay, like, half the audience agrees with him, half the audience agrees with me. It might be better if I was just not focused on that at all.
Right. Yeah,
although,
exactly.
I've got to say, and maybe this is just the human brain focusing on the negative, I definitely only heard the people in the audience who were supporting my opponent in the debate. So it felt like he had much greater support than he actually did.
Well, there you go. So you're then, I think, elaborating on my point. I would advise anybody who actually runs your debates at the shell to save it until the end. You know, the point again, the end is you know, that's the Tootsie Roll climax. It gives you a little bit of a point to the evening. And so I announced, well, the initial vote, you would have done, the initial vote was even 36. And now what's happened? You know, so then you announce the whole damn thing. And then, as you say, in your own case, it takes the sort of the crazy pressure off. You're there to make the best case you can. And the numbers are not going to do you any good, and they could put undue pressure on you. And as I say as well, it makes a little bit too much of a thing out of the Oxford style voting. I just want it as a kind of an end to the evening without making it as though it's the conclusion to the evening. Yeah. So that's the other bit of advice I have about that. Well, we're running short on time, Max. I'm actually, but. It's a pleasure talking to you. Let me just look over the rest. the rest of your suggestions.
Okay.
Well, and then the third, see what your opponent and those on the same side as your opponent have said about the issue in the past. Well, I got that from you. Oh, yeah. I would use stronger language there. I would say again that the key, the absolute key, is do your homework. And sometimes it's painful. When I debated Ben Burgess, I found that versus, for example, debating Richard Wolff, another socialist, Richard Wolff had happily left a whole trail of writings that I could skim. I didn't have to read every paragraph and all the rest of it. So I could go over his writings and a few of his discussions. Ben Burgess had left fewer writings, but many more discussions. So, for example, I had to suffer through an entire debate he did with David Friedman, which I had subjected myself to because I want to make sure I'm familiar with the kind of arguments he makes. And it was, a matter of fact, only when I heard him debate David Friedman that I heard the biggest howler that he's capable of, that he actually does want to criminally prosecute anybody in a socialist society who wants to work for a conventionally managed firm. He would forbid such firms to be formed, and he would make it a criminal offense to do. And I try to make the point that, you know, there are socialists who do want the iron fist of government to enforce worker ownership on firms. That's bad enough. But some of them at least would permit competition, would permit some of us to dissent and work for conventionally managed firms. Ben would not do so. And I think it's important to classify him as an authoritarian socialist and to differentiate him from the semi-liberal socialist who want government to force it on us, but would allow at least free market competition, the more reasonable socialist, the more open-minded types. And so I only discovered that particular cornerstone of his argument by listening to his debate with David Friedman. And it's important. So therefore, do your homework, do a deep dive into everything that your opponent has said, so that especially if you're the negative, you can really prepare. And there's very few surprises then for you.
Yeah.
You will show up and you're thinking, as I perhaps said, and I've outed him a lot, even though I have a high regard for him. Ben Powell, who's at Texas Tech, who debated immigration, he had not read the book written by his opponent, and therefore he was talking past his opponent too often. He wasn't because you have limited time. You want to focus your arguments on the argument being made by your opponent, and that's important. So therefore, very important to do the deep dive. As you know, you have to hold your nose because in the age of podcasts and interviews, sometimes you have to sit through something that you find rather wearing in order to understand what your opponent thinks. It's much easier to skim the opponent's writings than to listen to what he had to say. But sometimes you have no choice but to do that. Yeah.
Well, it's better because then you get to hear what they're saying on their own rather than their edited, you know, final product.
Well, that's right. Well, because your point is often what they say in interviews and in other debates they might have had is really more of a prediction, more of what they're going to say when they debate you.
Yeah. Also, update. They people update their arguments every time they like. If you write a book and then you go out talking about your book for a year and doing back and forths, you're going to change you're going to change the way you talk about.
Oh yeah. No. I will tell you, by the way, that I listened happily. I didn't have to listen. I made that. Benjamin Applebaum did a long interview on Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, and that was my New York Times opponent in my debate with him. And there was a transcript produced, and I will tell you that I could have embarrassed Benjamin because he keeps changing his story. Really, the best summary of it is he did a book and he wanted to give it some point. Well, free market ideology is at fault. But really, he was just doing a sort of a breezy history. And so he made different arguments to Russ than he made to me. He's really a moving target because he is so confused. So therefore, every once in a while, particularly the evolution of your opponent's argument is such that you see that if he seems to change his tune from what he wrote and then change his tune again, you're going to have to say, I don't know what the heck he's going to say the next time. He may change his tune once more, you know. And so that's a little bit of a problem. Well, sometimes I did miss the opportunity to quote him against himself a couple of times. I could go into that, but not a big deal. Quote him against himself by pointing out that, you know, Benjamin said one other thing. He said something completely different when he was interviewed by Russ Roberts. Would have been unfair. Well, now this is Benjamin's argument. Fine, I'll deal with it. But it's not what he believed in a year ago. It's like taking pot shots at him. So sometimes you run into that problem. But do your homework. Do your homework. That's the most important thing. Edit, edit, edit. When you answer questions, refer to the ideas that you've already established. That's good. Pick your battles. Most difficult, because often your opponent is coming at you with all kinds of arguments, and you can't respond to all of them. And that gets back to sort of like hopefully reading the mind of those people who might be on the fence,
I think that's more of an experience thing too. Like you get more experienced at it as time goes on. Cause that was in my first debate attempt. That was, I found that the most difficult.
Well, you know, I hate to be pessimistic, but the fact is that, you know, I've done like now 7 or 8 debates. The topics change. You know, admittedly, I've 3 out of my 8 debates were with socialists. So there I'm repeating myself a little bit. But the other 5 debates were about different topics. And sometimes then you never quite know. And you're against somebody who's got particular issues. So you never quite know. But experience probably helps. Deploy the best stories to illustrate your main arguments. Chill out. And remember, good sportsmanship. Well, those are wise words, Max.
And, thanks.
So you and I have taken more than an hour of your listeners' time, and I guess we've exhausted them completely when it comes to doing debate. In the end, this is the real reflection that you and I would have, Max, which is that in the end, we want to share our wisdom with others. We want to educate. And lectures and discussions and interviews and books and articles, I benefit from all of those as a source of my continuing education. I've always felt, however, that debates are a necessary part of our education, and that while they're never necessarily decisive in our education, they can always teach you things. I myself have modified my views, and I've said this before in public, that I modified my views about fractional reserve banking when I heard a Soho Forum debate we did on it. So people ask me, have you ever changed your mind? I often say, well, I've never quite changed my mind, but certainly, although in that particular case I did, but certainly I've sharpened my understanding of the issues by listening to a lot of the debates. And my point then is that while you and I are focusing on, so to speak, the game of debating, the ultimate goal is to educate ourselves by debating and educate others by doing a debate in front of others. And that ultimately then we're appearing before people who are intellectually curious, which is a point I missed stressing initially, because yes, we want entertainment, we want the drama, but really you have to walk into that hall as an intellectually curious person who enjoys listening to the clash of ideas and hopes to pick up on some insights from these particular occasions. Everything from books to articles to interviews to discussions to seminars to panels to debates, they all have their strengths and their limitations with respect to ways in which we might educate ourselves. And you and I just understand that debates do contribute, and that's why you and I believe in the idea of debate.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better, but you know, I'm reminded of, you know, that there's a saying that you don't truly understand something unless you can explain it to someone or teach it to someone else, you know, until you become a teacher. But, you know, debating is a big part of that. You really don't understand an argument until you have someone there who's trying to knock it down.
Yeah. It was actually John Stuart Mill, actually, in his book on liberty, who went to the extreme of the point that you really have to be able to make the argument for the other side. I find in order to understand your position, I would say do a deep dive into what I think he went to the extreme of the point. But of course, you're correct. Indeed, it sharpens your thinking. You just remind me a little bit. I object a little bit to college debating or high school debating, where it's almost like like it's strictly a game and there are no convictions, and you have to take, you have to show you can take both sides of the argument. I think that's a little bit extreme, but certainly the idea of taking the other side of the argument helps you understand the weaknesses in it and possibly makes you understand the strength. I did come in before I heard the debate between George Shelton and Bob Murphy, I was more on Bob's side, although Bob Murphy, I think, has changed his position a little bit. But I began to see that there was more of an argument for fractional reserve, for allowing fractional reserve banking in a free market to happen, because the banks will discipline the other banks that misbehave. Shareholders will depositors will discipline them as well. And so I think let it happen. Bob Murphy even said at one point that passing a law against it is not a hill I want to die on. Hans Hermann Hoppe, by the way, and others, the Mises School, some want to pass a law prohibiting fractional reserve banking. I don't think that's useful. I think that you just want to see what happens in a free market in banking and not be surprised if there is some fractional reserve banking practiced. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Just to broaden it a little bit, yes. To summarize, and then I'll let you have the last word.
Because I ended up on a narrow provincial.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, learning through these debates, for me is really why I so strongly believe in like freedom of speech. I really believe that we can't truly understand, even if we're not going to change our mind to hear more speech, we're not going to truly understand our own positions without hearing many sides to it. And I've always supported freedom of speech. Like I just inherently supported it even when I was younger. It wasn't considered a right-wing issue. Hopefully 10 years from now, it won't be considered a right-wing issue and it will be a broad issue once again.
That's
very important.
That's right. And indeed, now the ultimate civil debate, if the idea that I can meet with a New York Times guy with whom I deeply disagree, but he can come to our reception afterward and sell his books and eat our food and drink our drink, that civil debate without insult, without violence, without upset, without saying, oh, your positions traumatize me so that I can't even listen to you, all of that is also what you and I stand for, Max. So I've just had the final word, Max. So over and out. A pleasure.
All right.
Hopefully I'll see you again unless you want to come to New York and visit, come to our debates. Oh, yeah.
I might.
When is this going to be aired, Max?
I'm guessing this month, like by the end of the year, we'll have a few. I'll probably save this for Christmas week or something.
Oh, okay.
So that way I'll be, it's in 2 weeks.
Then I want to make an announcement. Give me the chance to make my announcement about SoFoam. Our next debate, look on our website, thesoFoam.org, for the exact date in January, where Larry White will be defending the resolution about abolishing the Federal Reserve against Lawrence Mishkin, who's a very well-established monetarist at Columbia University. Again, this will be the classic case by an advocate like Larry White on the need to abolish the Federal Reserve. But then on top of that, I'm inaugurating a new venture for the Soul Forum. A couple of days later, which will be on a Sunday afternoon, this will be you'll be available to buy tickets for this. Larry White, the same debater, is going to come. The debate's going to be on a Thursday evening. I think that's January 26th. A few days later, he's going to come to my home, and we're going to have a Soul Forum's Bastiat Society salon, in which we discuss the issues of the debate and put Larry in the hot seat. And so my plan, if there's enough interest, is to have a Soul Forum salon following each debate in my home, in which you watch the debate and you discuss it, just like Max and I have done, and in order to sort of deepen your understanding of the issues raised. And so if you buy tickets to Larry's debate and you're in town, you can sign up for a seminar, our salon, discussing that debate. That will be in January. Check thesoulforum.org for the time and to buy tickets for that debate.
All right. Fantastic. That'll all be on the show notes page, and this will go out before those debates happen. Gene, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it today.
Pleasure as always, Max. Bye-bye.
That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, Sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.